Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. We've reached our penultimate episode and our look back at Apollo 11 50 years ago. Later on, we'll get a historical perspective on Project Apollo from John Logsdon, the founder and former director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University and one of the world's foremost authorities on the history of the space program. But our first guest is truly a special one. In the early morning hours, before Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins climbed in the command module Columbia on July 16th, 1969, to begin their voyage into history, this man was in the spacecraft making sure that every switch was properly set. He was the last person to leave Columbia before the prime crew ingressed or got in. You probably are familiar with Fred Hayes as one of the Apollo 13 astronauts, and he was famously played by Bill Paxton in the movie. But Hayes, known as Fredo to his friends, was also the backup lunar module pilot on Apollo 11 and had to be fully prepared to fly the mission. Hayes joined us from his home in Houston to talk about his role in landing the first men on the moon. When you were a kid, were you interested in flight or science and technology at all, or did that come later?
That came later.
And when did that start? Was it with your military flying career? How did you get involved in military flying?
Well, that was the turning point. I was, through high school, I'd gotten interested in the high school newspaper, was sports editor, and enjoyed it. And decided to, when I went off to community college, a junior college it was called in Mississippi, but for 2 years I majored in journalism. I was thinking of continuing that career with my thought at the finishing up in 1952. I was thinking of going to University of Missouri, which was a noted school in journalism. But the Korean War had was ongoing. And I decided to serve the military, my tour in the military. And with 2 years of college, at the age I was, the only program I could get into to get a commission, become an officer, that my dad had always encouraged was the Naval Aviation Cadet Program. So I signed up, but you'll have to realize at that time, at the point I did that, I'd never been in an airplane in my life.
Wow.
Not even sitting on the ground. So it was a big step, and that, without knowing how well that would turn out, just to get the commission. But the first time I flew, after 4 months of pre-flight, and got to fly with a flight instructor, it was sort of like magical, being up and looking down at the ground and maneuvering around with the aircraft. That just changed everything. I decided right then my career somehow was going to be involved with airplanes and aviation.
Wow. Well, let's talk about your path to NASA, because from my understanding, you were both in the Marines and the Air Force. You were a test pilot, right?
At a different time. When I finished flight training, I went into Marine Corps and served in two Marine fighter squadrons. VMF 533 and 114. The Air Force came much, much later. It was actually after I was working for NASA.
When you were flying for the military, did you have any experiences that, you know, were, shall we say, a bit hairy?
Yeah, I had a few. I was flying wing on another aircraft out of Cherry Point, my Marine squadron. And we got in a thunderstorm very high up, over 40,000 feet. And when he pushed over, I was flying in his wing. I was a little behind and pushed over a little harder, and both engines quit. So I ended up gliding downward, and I lost him. I couldn't stay with him because he wasn't going to shut off his engines. And I went east out over the Atlantic to let down, knowing that that would keep me clear of any airline traffic or anything. And I could not, my radio would not tune in to the Marine station. I needed to land, Marine Masters. And their equipment to give me a UHF, what they call DF steer, was broken. So I couldn't get that. And radar couldn't get me. So anyway, I ended up landing at a very small field, Tamiami Trails, did a sort of a carrier landing because I knew it was a short field, and blew a tire and went off the runway to the side, and ended up getting towed out of there. It was too short a field to take off, and so I got towed down the highway to the international airport. And so that was one experience. The other one was I just stalled during a carrier approach one day on shore on the airfield, but hit down and drugged the tail a little bit and bent a flap up, but got airborne again. So that was the primary two events I had in my Marine flying experience.
Wow. And let's flash forward to 1961, May, when President John F. Kennedy sets the goal to commit the nation to land a man on the moon before the decade is out, returning him safely to Earth. This is before, of course, you were an astronaut. But do you remember, you know, what you were thinking when you heard about, you know, we're going to the moon? Did you at any point around then start thinking about that might be something you'd like to be involved in? Or could you have imagined you would be?
No, I did not at that time. I thought it was a pretty incredible step, knowing just kind of roughly where we were with rockets and rocket engines and what we had done to that point, which was, you know, fly people in a very small capsule in Mercury. And at the time, I think we'd only launched Shepard.
Yeah, just a 15-minute flight.
Yeah, so it you know, it seemed like a pretty bold step, but no, I didn't immediately say I'm going to go sign up.
Okay, so when did you make that decision? How did that come about? Because you're part of the fifth astronaut group, the 19, and they were selected in 1966, as I recall. When did you decide to go on that path?
Well, I was at Lewis 3.5 years, and I transferred to Edwards Flight Research Center for NASA, which really was the premier flight test operation for NASA. It's where the X-15 program was still ongoing that Neil had flown, and he had left. By the time I left, he had left about a year before and gone into the astronaut program before I transferred from Cleveland, Lewis, Glenn now, to Flight Research Center, which is now, of course, named Armstrong after Neil. And I was having a lot of fun flying many, many different kinds of airplanes on a regular basis. It normally involved in either support roles or directly in several test programs at the same time. So it was a great flying time for me. Most fun time of my whole career was there. And I did go off for 1 year into the aerospace test pilot school, the Air Force school, and actually got to go through both halves. And normally a civilian only got to go through the first 6 months, which was called a true test pilot school. And then they had an aerospace portion that only U.S. military got to go through, not even the foreign military.
Fred, is that the one that General Chuck Yeager was commanding?
That's correct. He was commanding, and he had asked me if I wanted to go through the second half of the school, actually, after I finished the first half. And I told him I'd have to talk to my boss, Joe Walker, and he said, no, I'll talk to him, and he did. He probably talked to Joe and Paul Bickel, who was then the director. And they said I could go through the second half of the school, the second 6 months. And so once I got back from that and got back into for another year back at Flight Research Center, again, heavy flying support still for X-15, weather flights, chase flights, checking uprange lake beds, whether fixing the land, but also I was involved in a full-blown test program on 7 general aviation aircraft, which later got published in a technical note, full stability and control and dynamics testing on those aircraft, that I started thinking near the end of that year about possibly joining the space program. Now, it was a hard choice because I talked to Don Malik, who I was very close to. We'd gone to Flight Research Center about the same time. He had transferred from NASA Langley, and I transferred from NASA Glenn. And he said he'd talked to Neil about being in the space program, and Neil's analysis to him was, you get to sit in a lot of meetings, you get to sit in a simulator a lot, and it's not much good flying. Mm-hmm. So that was Neil's description of being in the astronaut program. And I said, well, it's really a golden opportunity. I knew at Edwards, if I stayed, I would never get to fly the X-15, because in our office, we sort of went by seniority, and I was still at least two people ahead of me. There was two people ahead of me to fly the X-15, so I knew I would probably never get a chance. So I decided to take a chance and apply and hope that I might get a chance to have a lunar flight.
And do you remember the moment you found out you were an astronaut? How did that come about?
It was just a call from Deke.
Deke Slayton.
Yeah, Deke Slayton, and told me I'd made the grade. And so for me, it was just another transfer. I was I'm always a NASA employee. So for me, it was just moving to another NASA center.
You make me smile, Fred, because, you know, Deke Slayton is one of the original seven Mercury astronauts in the head. You know, when you say just a call from Deke, that just makes me laugh. Okay, well, let's get to crew selection, because Deke Slayton, of course, famously was the one who selected the crews for the Apollo missions and the Gemini missions before. How did it come about that you were selected to your first crew? Was your first crew selection a backup for Apollo 11, or was there something before that?
No, my first selection appointment, if you call it, was as the backup crew on Apollo 8. The backup crew on Apollo 8 was Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and myself. We were the Apollo 8 backup.
And what was your role in that? Were you a command module? Or?
Yeah, I was a lunar module pilot, right.
Oh, okay. And what was Buzz's role?
Buzz was command module pilot.
Oh, I see. And of course, later he would become lunar module pilot. And of course, you're the prime crew with Jim Lovell, Frank Borman, and William Anders, and famously, later on Apollo 13, Jim Lovell becomes your commander. I'm curious about when you found out you were going to be backup for Apollo 11. Did that just happen naturally because of the rotation from 8 to backing up 11?
Right, exactly. We normally rotated at three mission cycle. So, you know, that was great to get that first assignment, because that kind of puts you into the loop to work your way toward a prime crew and getting to fly. And that's what I'm saying. Normally you would cycle three crews.
And can you explain to us what is the role of a backup crew? What do you actually do? And maybe compare that to the prime crew. So let's talk about Apollo 11. Tell us about the role that you had. You were with Jim Lovell, right?
Right.
And then the other member of your crew was
Ken Mattingly.
Ken Mattingly. Okay. So the Apollo 13 crew. Tell us about the role that you guys had working with the prime crew. Tell us about what you actually did as a backup crew.
Okay. I think it's greatly misunderstood by a lot of people. Basically, you train to go fly the mission. You do the same thing as the prime crew. We alternated simulators, normally morning or afternoon. You're generally always in the same meetings, and you have a say about procedural things that may to be talking about. Obviously, the prime crew, the commander there has the overall say, but you were part of any decision making that was done that way. And obviously that proved that Jack Swigert jumped in for Ken 2.5 days before launch. You could have changed out the whole crew a week before launch and it wouldn't have mattered. We basically were ready to go fly.
Yeah, and when you think about it, when I was thinking about this, you know, as I thought about talking to you today, you know, it's very possible that something could have happened to Buzz Aldrin, you know, an accident or some illness or something, and you would have been, you know, the second person to step on the moon.
That's correct. I mean, that's what the backup crew did, was train to be able to go if needed.
Can you tell us a bit about what it was like working in those simulators? Can you describe to us what the lunar module simulator, for example, what was that like?
Well, this command module, in pretty much the same way, they could replicate all the functional parts of all the systems, be it electrical, environmental, the reaction controls, propulsion systems. All of that was replicated, obviously, through software. But it was able to give to you on your panel all the right readings on instruments for the conditions. There was capability of imparting failures into the various systems, what we call credible failures. I don't know how many in the LEM, but I know the command module simulators, they could put a little over 500 failures in. That would conceivably could happen in the various systems. The visuals in the command module simulator now could give you, you know, Earth horizon, lunar horizon, and some lunar landscape. But then obviously you could have good star patterns, but was not what I call high quality as you'd find in any aviation simulator today. The LEM got better simulation for landing, the lunar module, because what they created, I guess, out of plaster Paris, was a replica, at least to the definition they had from lunar orbiter, of your landscape for landing. And so there was a little camera that actually would relatively follow your descent profile to make the ground, you know, get larger as you more definition as you got lower, all the way down to a landing. So you had pretty high quality out the front windows for the landing scene in the lunar module simulator. But similarly, its systems were replicated for all the instruments, and failures had failures to be imparted in those various systems. So it was quite realistic, and actually the training, some of it we did standalone, where it was just you and the simulator instructors. But we also had quite a number of times we actually were connected data-wise with the mission control in what we called integrated simulations. And these were run full up for certain portions of the missions, like launch or entry or going in the lunar orbit or lunar landing, et cetera. And for those now, there was run a little different. There was a group of people that were specially chosen, and they devised a set of failures to be imparted at specific times to, and these people were pretty devious. They hoped to make us look bad, either us or our mission control in combination, to not be able to handle what they threw at us. So we went through several thousand hours of those kind of simulations.
Kind of reminds me of a coach, a basketball coach or a football coach, trying to make the practice harder than the game, so that when you get to the actual game, it doesn't seem so bad, because they're actually trying to throw things at you that are going to kill you, right?
Exactly. And what they did, though, when you got close to the mission time in the last couple of weeks, we would then get some runs with nothing happening, which would kind of be like the real flight. And you'd sort of get a better feel of the timeline without the interruptions.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we talk to Apollo 13 astronaut Fred Hayes. Fred was on the backup crew for Apollo 11 50 years ago this week. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. We'll be right back. And we're back. And thanks for listening as we commemorate the first moon landing, the Apollo 11 mission 50 years ago, with Apollo 11 backup astronaut and Apollo 13 prime crew member, Fred Hayes. Can you explain to us, because we're 50 years out, and for a lot of our listeners, they really don't understand, you know, the complexity of and the uniqueness of that spacecraft, because it was the only craft I can think of that was designed, you know, solely to fly in space. And the only way you could test it with human beings on board was to test fly it in space, which they did on Apollo 9 and Apollo 10 before the landing on 11. Tell us about the lunar module. Could you give us, you know, give us a thumbnail sketch about that spacecraft and your take on it?
Okay, the one thing that was a tremendous challenge was weight control. We had an engine, a decent engine, and it was sort of already down the road and fixed. So you had to live with that engine and its performance capability, both the descent and the ascent engine. So the vehicle itself, the hardware and the weight control was premium. We had what we call a WIP, Weight Improvement Program, WIP, and then we had a SWIP, Super Weight Improvement Program. Mm-hmm. And actually, where possible, in some ways, the primary members and joints were hollowed out to a point to get rid of weight. It was probably the toughest weight challenge of anything that ever flew. And that's one big challenge. The systems themselves, though, as you said, were able to operate only in space. So the vehicle had to operate in both vacuum and the normal cabin pressure, which was 5 psi. So everything was designed for that environment as well. For instance, the cabin fans, again, for lightweight, were skimped to only operate at that 5 psi oxygen environment. So in tests in the plant, when we had to turn on the cabin fans for a certain sequence we were running, it was timed how long they were on, because you could actually burn up the motor in the thicker air that we're sitting in here talking.
Wow. Yeah, 14 PSI.
14 PSI, yeah. And the water sublimator, which was the primary cooling for the vehicle, you could not activate except in space, and you had to do a careful power-up to not overload, or the ice would never form on the sublimator, which was essential. Things like that. So it's highly, the communication system and the chamber, we had to use normal hard line hookup for voice to the crew when you're in a chamber test until you got to about over 60,000 feet, or you got arcing, because all that electronic equipment was just sitting outside on the back side of the limb. I think what we call equipment bay 4 or 5. And so you had that limitation. You couldn't turn on the communication sitting on the ground.
And the walls, the spacecraft itself was, you know, very thin. As I recall, there were you could probably easily just punch your fist right through places in it if you were foolish enough to do that. Is that true?
That's exaggerated. It's not that thin. But it is. It's the thinnest possible aluminum shell you could have for aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you could punch your fist through it.
Well, that's good.
We didn't have inner walls. We had netting that sort of kept you a little bit from bumping in the wiring bundles and plumbing, because all of that you could see looking through that netting inner wall. Couldn't afford the weight of a normal wall. Again, you know, in comparison, the command module was built like a battleship compared to the LEM. Of course, it had to survive the loads, the aerodynamic loads of launch and entry. And that of course, that was why it had to be that strong.
Well, tell us about once Apollo 11 lifts off, your role as the backup crew. What do you do during flight?
Well, first of all, The morning of the launch, I actually was out at the spacecraft, I think a little before midnight. And I had the job of setting up all the switches with the launch director. You know, it was kind of a rote step-by-step. They'd give a command and I'd follow through the command. But to basically get the cockpit ready for the crew entry. And so eventually they showed up, the crew did, with the suit techs, and with me up on the stack were three other people, a part of the six people closeout crew, they call it. So I mainly, when the crew got there, just helped the suit techs, would hand them straps and things as they were hooking up the crew, getting them the hoses hooked up and the communication lines, and then the restraint straps in place. And I was the last one out of the capsule. To get out, I had to crawl underneath the couches and exit at the front, and then crawl out over the hatch lid on the front to get out of the capsule.
And then, of course, the next people inside there were the crew of Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins, right?
Right, yeah. And then, wow. then the hatch got closed, and the technicians, North American Aviation and NASA Quality, oversaw their getting the hatch shut and sealed, and was tested, sealed, and before we left, actually, we left the scene, the closeout crew.
Where were you when the actual landing happened on July 20th and the walk on the moon? Where were you for that?
Okay, for the landing, I was in mission control. That was fairly traditional. The backup crew during critical phases would be in mission control because obviously they knew what the crew had to be doing or was doing because we're trained to do it. And the thought was maybe if something was awry, we could somehow help. It turned out I never did impart any help, but nevertheless, that was kind of the role for a possibility of being able to help. For the EVA, I was at Buzz's house. I went to his house because, again, that particular phase, thought it'd be interesting, not interesting, but worthwhile to be there to describe, answer any questions or whatever, what was going on to his wife and his family during that part.
During the landing, there's, of course, the famous computer overloads, the 1201 and 1202 alarms, and the getting down to the 30 seconds of fuel, where after Neil has to fly over the boulder field and land Eagle after having to go a little long. Can you tell us, was that really that tense as it's been portrayed? What was that like for you as you were going through those final seconds waiting for Eagle to touch down?
Well, the alarms didn't immediately bother me, even though I did not know what those alarms were, because Neil was still controlling the vehicle. It was not affecting his flight control. He was still handling the vehicle and maneuvering. What really was, I call the most tense, was they were getting really close on fuel and possibly might have to abort just because they passed, to call it, the red line. And would not be able to land because of that reason, not the alarms. But that was primarily because of my ignorance, that I didn't have my GNC handbook with me to tell what those alarms were. So I didn't know what they were. But like I'm saying, the vehicle didn't go out of control, or there wasn't any big perturbation that way.
And what was it like the moment they touched down, knowing that, this is the moment where we've actually done it, landed on the moon?
Well, it may have been different degrees of excitement, but certainly I felt excited and proud that we had accomplished what, would was set out to do some years before. And here it had been done. So I had that feeling, and I like I say, different people maybe have different levels of excitement, but I was certainly excited that we had done it.
And now that we're 50 years on, do you have any different kind of perspective on the Apollo era now that you're 50 years out than from when you were directly involved in it? What do you think the legacy of Project Apollo is as you look back on it 50 years later?
Well, to me, it's sort of like if you have what would almost appear at that time as a Mission Impossible or unreachable goal, that if you really are willing to pay the price, and in that case the budget required at that time, and you assemble the right talent base, literally you can do something that you really question could you do. And that's what Apollo was all about. It was kind of achieving a big, big stretch and a goal that without the kind of efforts that was put in place and the number of people and the right brain power could not have been done. So that's what I think of Apollo. It was, and I just have to, looking back, I just feel very, very happy that I was literally born at the right time to be a part of it.
People like myself, we love you, the Apollo astronauts. You're our heroes growing up, and you still are. But also, the heroes of the story of Project Apollo are the hundreds of thousands of workers who dedicated, you know, just a tremendous amount of hours and effort to making this all work, because they are also the heroes of this story.
Amen.
Thank you so much, Fred Hayes.
All right. Bye-bye.
And enjoy the 50-year celebrations.
I will. All right, sir. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much to astronaut Fred Hayes. All of the Apollo astronauts are in heavy demand this year, as you might imagine. So to get Fred on the show was an absolute treat. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Our next guest is someone who knows Fred Hayes quite well. Bill Moore is a space historian from Oklahoma and also a personal friend of the Apollo 13 astronaut. One day, when I was texting him, he texted back that he was really busy because he had to go pick up Fred Hayes at the airport, which I thought was pretty cool. So I asked him to tell us about his friend, the man who should have been the sixth to set foot upon the moon.
You know, one thing that really strikes me about Fred is he's consistently the same. He doesn't have the highs or the lows. He doesn't really get, you know, excited or depressed. He just has that even keel about him. And I imagine that served him well on Apollo 13.
Yeah, as they say in the movie, The Right Stuff, he maintains an even strain.
That's it. Exactly.
As you've gotten to know him, tell us a bit about your experiences with him as a human being, and where you put him, like, compared to some of the other astronauts. Tell us a bit about some of your experiences, just, you know, hanging out with him.
Sure. Well, I flew down to Houston to visit with him. I'm working with him on his autobiography, and he picked me up at the airport there at Houston Hobby, and I climb in the van, and right in the middle, he's got a dog bed, and he's got his little dog, Tito, sitting there riding with him. So he's just a common, regular person who's gone the furthest out in space. So, you know, it's always amazing to me when I visit with the astronauts, and you stop every once in a while, and you have to think, my gosh, where this person has been, to the moon, further out. It's just amazing to look at. You've got like Gene Cernan, who was very peppy, you might say, really, you know, really pumped a lot of the time. He was always excited about talking about the space program and really promoting it. And, you know, like Tom Stafford, he's so cerebral. And always looking behind the scenes of things, always really trying to analyze and compare and contrast. And Fred, he is just, he's so brilliantly quiet and even keeled.
Just an easy person to be around.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anybody who's a dog person is generally okay by me.
Yes, Tito is he's well liked. He takes him to the Infinity Science Center, which is in Mississippi there, where Fred helps them a lot at the Infinity Museum, and Tito's well known by folks who visit there and see Fred.
Fred and Tito.
Fred and Tito.
As you have your understanding of what happened 50 years ago this summer has evolved, and your understanding of the space program has deepened, what's some of the things that, you know, now that you really know about the Apollo program in general and Apollo 11 particularly, what's like your big takeaway this summer?
I've come to understand how unique and how special that time was, just from the fact that over that time period of 3 years, we had those few moon landings, and I had no idea at the time that it would be this long, and I may not live to see us go back to the moon. Who knows? I mean, I know they're saying 2024. I would like to have seen more of our efforts in space towards exploration, and I understand the space station has been an amazing thing, and I love it, but the journey of going to the moon and what that would be like for each generation to experience, you know, I think there's like a third of today's population was born before Apollo 11. So two-thirds of today's population, the moon landing has always been a fact. It's always been there. So that's a tough thing because people don't know the specialness of what it was. And missing what we experienced back then, that's something that this world today needs. It needs those kind of heroes. It needs that kind of excitement. And it needs those accomplishments and achievements that, you know, stir your blood and get your pride really strong in your country and what's going on in the world.
I think my biggest takeaway is realizing, and I had a sense of it, but, you know, being 9, you know, your understanding of things isn't as deep as when you're 59, is just how dangerous it was.
Yeah. That's why they're heroes. I mean, they put it all on the line for us, and that was more evident in Apollo 13 than any of the other missions, and yet there were moments in each mission that things could have gone bad. So you're right. It's a very dangerous business. But they were ready for it. They were ready to go. And like Tom Stafford was saying at the Apollo 10 50th anniversary last month, he said, you know, we weren't scared at any moment. He said, we were test pilots. We knew the odds. We knew the equipment. And we knew what was out there for us to accomplish and to deal with. And that right there shows you what those early Apollo astronauts were like.
Well, thanks for talking to us about your friend, astronaut Fred Hayes, the lunar module pilot for the famous Apollo 13 mission and the backup pilot for Apollo 11. Thanks for joining us on Blue Dot.
Thank you.
Thanks to Oklahoma space historian Bill Moore for his perspective on his friend, Apollo 11 backup and Apollo 13 prime crew member, Fred Hayes. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll put Apollo 11 in historical context with the Dean of American Space Historians, John Logsdon. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Stay with us. And we're back. As Blue Dot closes out this look at Apollo 11 50 years later, let's talk to one of the preeminent experts in the world on the history of the space program. John Logsdon founded the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University and was its director from 1987 to 2008. He is the Professor Emeritus of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs in Washington, D.C., and the author of the 2010 book, John F. Kennedy and the Race to the Moon. Professor Logsdon, welcome to Blue Dot.
Glad to be with you.
First of all, I've known about you for many years. It's like whenever I'm watching a documentary about the space race, you are usually one of the guys that's a go-to guy for people that produce stuff about that. I'm curious, how did you become an expert on space policy and history? When did that become a major interest for you?
Well, I'll try to be short, but it's a fairly long story. Back in the early 60s, I was getting ready to go back to graduate school. I was bored with the job I had gotten with a physics degree as a technical writer, and I knew I was going back to graduate school in political science. And then in New York City on March the 1st, 1962, I saw John Glenn parade through the city after his first flight and said, "Hey, this space stuff is interesting." And every paper I wrote in graduate school, culminating in my dissertation, which was about Kennedy's decision to go to the moon, was on a space topic. So, I started down that path and it's carried me to where I am today.
Wow. Well, that's way cool. I've always enjoyed your take on things. Very, very informative. And so I'm going to ask you questions that I get asked a lot. So, I can get your take on it because, to me, you're one of the world's foremost experts on this. I'd like to first of all talk to you about John F. Kennedy. And if you could describe for us a little bit his evolution from the time he gets into office and the decision to go to the moon until about the time he's assassinated, take us through his journey, because as I understand it, he wasn't totally gung-ho about NASA right in the beginning, was he?
Well, as a senator during the 50s, he had not paid much attention to Sputnik and its impacts and the creation of NASA. He was not one of the major actors in creating NASA. His vice president, Lyndon Johnson, a Senate majority leader, was. So when Kennedy was elected, he gave to Lyndon Johnson the lead role in his new administration on space policy, had the law changed to make the vice president rather than the president head of a thing called the National Aeronautics and Space Council, which had responsibility for formulating space policy. And that was January, February, March of 1961. Kennedy took office on January the 20th, 1961. Then came Yuri Gagarin, and the first human to orbit the Earth, and the world and the domestic U.S. political reaction to that achievement was very strong and very positive. Khrushchev claimed it was evidence of the superiority of the Soviet form of societal and political organization. And Kennedy said, "Hey, this is something where I better pay attention," and the United States should not be by default in a second position in this new arena. So from April the 12th, 61 on, Kennedy basically took space as an issue back from LBJ. But he did ask Johnson to run a review. The memo he wrote to Johnson, dated April the 20th, 1961, asked for a review to identify, and I quote, "a space program which promises dramatic results in which we could win." A pretty clear set of requirements. And LBJ did organize that review, consulted NASA, DOD, others inside the government, his former colleagues in the Congress, particularly the Senate, brought in some outsiders, one of whom was Wernher von Braun. Although von Braun technically was four or five layers down in NASA, his personality and his persona had made him a trusted expert on space matters. And von Braun said the first thing that the United States has an excellent chance of doing first and producing dramatic results was sending people to the moon. Why? Because both the United States and the Soviet Union would have to build a big new rocket in order to achieve a lunar landing. And that perception formed the technical basis for the decision to set lunar landing as a national goal.
Where was he at as far as this as a political issue? Because it seems to me as a very political animal, you know, he really wants to see this, I would think, happen by the end of his second term, you know, hoping that this would happen while he's still in the White House, right?
Well, he was told in May of 61 that it would could conceivably be possible before the end of his second term, before 1968. I don't think that figured very deeply into his decision to do it. I think he decided it was right for the country to be the leading nation in space, that it did hold an important place in our international relationships, in our competition for the allegiance of newly independent countries who were picking whether to affiliate with the Soviet Union or the United States. It was kind of a zero-sum competition. So, yes, I mean, he was political, and that certainly was in his mind, but I don't think it was in the front of his mind.
Well, you've been studying this for your entire career, and you know now we're 50 years away from the events of July 1969. Is there anything that stands out to you personally now, you know, as you look back, where you've undergone any kind of personal evolution in the way you view the Apollo program, like some insights that you have now that are the product of those many years of scholarship?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was at the launch of Apollo 11. I stood there and saw these three men head off to the moon. I knew history was being made, and you know, it couldn't help but being very emotional and something that was really good for the country. And I think still think it was. But I have come to realize that by setting the end of the decade deadline and by making it a race, Kennedy forced the creation of hardware that wasn't good for much else. So after Apollo, the space program basically started over, at least the human spaceflight program. We stopped producing Saturn V. We stopped traveling into deep space. We've been since the last Apollo mission in December of 1972, we've been just in orbit a couple hundred miles above the Earth, which I find kind of deeply disappointing.
Yeah, and a thought occurred to me. It's like it's not too often that a historian gets to witness firsthand the history that he will be, you know, dealing with for his career. That's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it was remarkable.
And I get asked this question a lot. I'm sure you do too. And I have to get your elevator speech on this one because we're running a little short on time now. But when people ask you, you know, well, why haven't we been back to the moon? You know, now it's 50 years later. Why? You know, what's your answer to that?
Well, we haven't had the political will. There has been no compelling reason to undertake an Apollo-like space effort. And Kennedy in 61 viewed it as part of the Cold War competition for global leadership between the United States and the Soviet Union, and asked the question I said earlier, find me a space program which promises results in which we could win. There's been no similar question for the past 47 years, the answer to which is go back to the moon or on to Mars. And so it hasn't happened as a national initiative. I think it has to be now something we do because it's worth doing on its own sake, not as part of some broader foreign policy or international political initiative.
And as you see what's going on with, for example, SpaceX and the Falcon Heavy vehicle they just launched a week or so ago from the Kennedy Space Center, are you starting to see signs that we're going to be going back out into deep space anytime soon?
Oh, yeah, I think we're on our way. If you look at the policy, George W. Bush in 2004 said back to the moon, and basically nobody has argued since then on the resumption of deep space exploration. Mr. Obama said, been to the moon, let's go to Mars. But we've been preparing for resuming deep space exploration. NASA is in the end stages of building a big rocket like the Saturn V, a spacecraft called Orion capable of carrying people out to lunar distances. SpaceX and Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' company, have both indicated an interest in returning to the moon, returning people to the moon and beyond as one of their major goals. So I think by the end of the decade of the 2020s, there will be people on the moon, probably on a long-term
basis.
Okay,
well, last question for you. How are you going to celebrate 50 years later, like on July 16th, as we look back at the launch and the moon landing?
Well, on the 16th, I will be at Kennedy Space Center trying to immerse myself in the reenactment of the launch and of the people that were involved and try to immerse myself in recalling that half century ago period and my physically being a part of it.
Well, we got to let you go. But you know, thinking about that, I can't think of a better person to be at Kennedy Space Center and be immersing yourself in that history of 50 years ago than you, John Logsdon. I'm glad you're going to be there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it very much.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thanks to our guests, Apollo 13 astronaut and Buzz Aldrin's backup on Apollo 11, Fred Hayes, Oklahoma historian Bill Moore, and Professor Emeritus from George Washington University, John Logsdon. Blue Dot is produced by North State Public Radio. We're distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to us. Our podcast is on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our assistant producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.